Thanks, Jess. All right, how's the acoustics? That's kind of loud.
Can I turn that down?
All right. So I'm Frank. Thanks, all of you, for being here. I know after 3 days of, like, just fire hose information, the last session is always a little tired. Luckily, we have mead for you. Yes, yes. And as I imagine most of you know, it says in the Bible, give mead to him that is fading. Like 2,000 years ago, this is what they were giving people exactly in your spot. So we're going to be serving California oak, which is our American oaked ale yeast, wildflower honey, 12% San Diego style mead. And I'll get into what we mean by San Diego style mead later. But to me, this mead is light and refreshing, but packs a punch. It's a great gateway mead for a lot of our accounts and a lot of the people that we serve it to. We serve our mead in, I think, 80 different tap on-premise accounts and sell our bottles in about 200 stores throughout SoCal. We just signed a couple deals on the East Coast, which is pretty cool because we just, like, put mead on pallets and it disappears and then money appears in our bank accounts. And it's like, oh, my gosh, this is real? Which is a bit of a dream come true. But as I was putting this presentation together, you know, I realized there's a lot more questions than there are answers here. And that's one of the beautiful things about mead, right? We all have this opportunity to innovate together and share our knowledge and our best practices and carve out a whole new category of alcoholic beverages that is hopefully going to turn people on to the beauty inherent in the product in the glass, but also in the world around them. So that's what I want to talk to you about today, is our little interpretation of that. And we got Steve here pouring mead and pitchers, so I hope you have your glasses ready and available. And I hope that you enjoy it. Tasting notes on it. Hopefully you get honey up front. Then the oak comes through with a little bit of the vanillin, the tannin. And then that ale, very typical ale finish, should lead the finish note. And again, it's kind of a gateway mead. If people have never had mead on tap before, we hope they try it first. We did bring 4 kegs today, so there's going to be plenty of mead for everybody. all right, while the mead's going around, I got a couple questions for you guys. In the audience, show of hands, have you ever made mead before? Awesome. Oh my God, this is a dream come true. I don't have to go over like all the introductory stuff. Rad, how many people have made fewer than 5 batches of mead? So just a couple batches of mead, all right? How many people have made 25 or fewer batches? All right, and anyone over 25? Hell yeah, all right, that's what I'm talking about. So you know the history of mead then, right? We've got it being mentioned in like the Rig Veda in India, the Ethiopians in Africa, right? Like our earliest hunter-gatherer ancestors were making mead that had just wild fermented, or they found a hot beehive, stored the honey in water, and it got fermented from the yeast just floating around in the air. Of course, the Vikings. Then it shows up in culture all over the world. Dostoevsky wrote about it. It's in the Rig Veda, like I mentioned, Vishnu walking across the universe and his footsteps are filled with mead, making morning, noon, and night. Like, this is epic stuff. In the Runahal, which is the Viking epic about Odin, he like gets the blood of the ogres that are there at the beginning of the world, and this is the mead of poetry. And he takes a drink of it, and he says, "A drink I took of the magic mead, and I began to know and to be wise, to grow and to weave poems." So, like, this stuff is epic, right? And it was forgotten about. But luckily, it stayed around in Beowulf and Harry Potter.
So, Gandalf.
Gandalf, of course. Well, I'll get to that later, actually. So, California oak, it's making its way to the back of the room. Good. Safale 05 was our yeast of choice. Basically, a California ale yeast, but a dry yeast. I'll talk about how we treat it with rehydration and nutrient additions, and that has made all the difference for us, and we're just at like the beginning of a new curve of experimentation and learning, and hopefully by sharing this with you, you guys will get out there and like skip all of the mistakes we made and go straight to making mead that is this good or better, right? Isn't that what we all want to do? So we make three other kinds of meads that we sell commercially. This is our Savage Bois, kind of a fun horizontal comparison. Saffale 05 again, but French oak. Totally changes the mead, right? Ken Schramm, who's in the audience, that man wrote the book that inspired me while I was on that Navy ship to think that making mead for a living was actually viable. So you're in the presence of, yeah. And of course, Michael Fairbrother and Susan Rudd, like, these were the guys that when I went to the Major Cup the first time, talking to them, it was like, they're doing it. I think I could do it too. And Susan, I'll get to what she told me later, because it is key to where we are in our industry. You can think about beer, right? Hundreds of years of tradition that was written down. Wine, thousands of years of tradition that was carried forward. The whole tradition of mead making was like forgotten. In the 1700s, people stopped doing it for the most part on an industrial scale. So you were lucky if you had some knowledge passed down. Now we're back at kind of scratch, and we all get to innovate together. Orange blossom, we use California orange blossom honey, ale yeast, and you get a very floral, somewhat effervescent, lighter-bodied orange blossom mead. And our sour mead, has anyone ever made Jun before? Stan has. One person. Awesome.
What is it?
Jun. Is that a hand in the back? All right. Jun is like kombucha, but made with a culture that is adapted to honey and green tea. So it's got White Labs analyzed what became our sour culture from our Jun fermentation, and like they saw 40 different microbes in there, Lactobacillus, Brett, and like I don't even know what else. But that is the culture that has helped us achieve this sour mead, and it's really different, dynamic, special. If you come up to the tasting room in Oceanside, you can try it out. It's often at Stone, World Gardens and Bistro, and a lot of the other craft beer stores throughout San Diego. But I want to talk about my first mead, and that's where Gandalf comes in. So my grandpa was an apple grower not far from here, about 2 hours away in Ucaipa. And when he retired from growing apples, he made fruit wine, he made berry wine, and he made some mead. And he sold it in the little tasting room on the family apple ranch. And I was little, and when he would pull out the mead, the room would just light up. People would just start laughing. It was totally different than the mood in the room when they were drinking wine. And I was like, Pop, what is this stuff? And he's like, oh, it's an adult drink made from honey. And I'm like, oh, honey's good. So maybe when I'm an adult, I'll like this stuff. But never got to try it. And then, like, it shows up in Tolkien. And I got the quote there, which is just epic stuff. And I'm going to read it to you. So forgive me. But the elves, like, they save the hobbits from the Dark Riders. Like, the hobbits don't even know how bad their fate is. And luckily, the elves just show up. And so the hobbits are, like, stoked, and they go up and have a party with the elves. And after they leave, the elves have filled their bottles with a clear drink, pale golden in color. It had the scent of honey made of many flowers and was wonderfully refreshing. Very soon they were laughing and snapping their fingers at rain and dark riders. Like, if that's not the feeling you get when you drink mead, maybe you need to refine your process, you know? So we discovered from the first mead my grandpa gave me, that it was a lot of fun, and that a mead party often became a dance party. So we started making it bigger and bigger batches, rented space from a winery. Now we're doing it in 1,000 gallons at a time, which your first 1,000-gallon batch is a lot different from your first 100-gallon batch, which is different from your first 5-gallon batch, but it's all good. And like the lessons that we've learned, I'm hoping that you guys will go forward from here knowing how to avoid some of the lessons that we learned very painfully. So it's a lot of fun up in Oceanside at the meadery. And of course, we all know that making mead is hopefully the fastest route to saving the bees, right? If we can get beekeepers to realize they can sell us honey at a higher price than their big honey brokers, then we can keep them in the game. In California, the average age of a beekeeper is 67 years old. No one else wants to do it anymore because it's really hard work and you don't get paid very well. But like wine grape growers were price takers up through the 50s and 60s, but then Mondavi and Parker came on the scene, or excuse me, not Parker, Gallo came on the scene, and people started paying the wages that they needed to be paid to grow these kinds of grapes. That's what I envision and a lot of us envision for the honey-making world, that through mead we can add a ton of value through fermentation and bring up the price of domestic honey and potentially help to solve these colony collapse disorder problems where 50% of beehives are dying every year, and get us towards a future where the bees' future is not in peril. So, as you all know, because you've all made mead, all you need is honey, water, and yeast. Mix them together, stir vigorously, add yeast, and let fermentation happen, right? That's it. Not. Right? Like, no, that is not it. Well, it is. It's one way to do it, but it's like, you're going to wait 6 months for like the airlock to finally stop bubbling. And then you're going to taste it, and you're going to be like, ooh, really? That took that long? And then you're going to be like, well, shoot. I guess I'll hold on to this. And maybe 2 years later, you're like, oh, this is awesome. But who's got 2 years to wait for their mead? And if you're running a business, like, that's a wine model, man. They make a profit after year 10. I would much rather follow a beer model where you make a profit after year, what year am I at now, 4.5? Year 5? Yeah, that's... So what we have here... There's Joe Connolly, he's in the audience today. He's mastering our aeration system there, where we're using our oil-less air compressor and some filters and pumping it directly through a sight glass into the fermentation vessel. We're adding nutrient, pumping it through, got our glycol chiller hooked up. It's a bit more complex than just honey, water, mix, add yeast, forget. So this is like your starting problem set. What honey ratio do you want to work with? Because you get totally different results on the backside. 1 to 3 is kind of your typical wine yeast that'll yield like 14 to 18% ABV. So 1 part honey to 3 parts water. We're using 1 to 4 with our ale yeast, and that totally has changed the game. Attenuation is very thorough, but a little bit of residual sugar. And then 1 to 8, so this guy Kyle Beverly, does anyone know Kyle? John does. Anyone else? Eric does. He wrote a great article where he shared a recipe for a sessionable hopped mead, only about 6% ABV, and that's his ratio, honey to water there. But he chose a yeast. Typically, when you start doing these hydromills, mouthfeel and body are very hard to achieve because you don't have the maltose and the dextrose that you would in beer. You don't have the tannins that you would in wine to give body to the end product. So he chose a yeast, Rhone 4600, that produces a ton of sterols, right? Fatty acids that create body as a byproduct of fermentation. So know that there are pros and cons of your choice here and think it out. Honey preparation, do you heat or not? Back when Ken Schramm did the first draft of his book, this was like a very active question, and it still kind of is, but a lot of people have left heating because it'd be like boiling your grapes before making wine, denaturing all of the subtle aromatic compounds that make mead so special when it's done well. So we don't heat anymore. We just take the honey right off of the barrel that we get it in and then mix it with spring water. And I didn't even put water up there because like that's just so far out of the realm of possibility at this point that I just use spring water. Like, I know that it makes the best mead I've ever made, so I'm going to keep with that until we have the time and bandwidth to start looking at that problem. Plus, we're in a drought. I mean, if you're drinking something, water was involved. But I guess you could harvest rainwater, which is what Pliny said, right? Like, that's the recipe that Pliny put forth, was like, harvest rainwater, take spring honey, mix them together, let it age for 2 years. So nutrient addition. So I'll get into that deeper, but that is a huge element for advanced to intermediate mead makers. Beginning mead makers, it's kind of like, skip that for now. And I'm spilling the mead. Temp control adjuncts. So hopefully you're done with your first sample. Is that the case? Cool, they're going to start coming around with the second sample so we can talk about the spectrum of mead. So like, when I'm out there introducing mead to hundreds of thousands of people, people are like, is it a beer or a wine? And I'm like, no, it is neither. And they're like, huh, well let me try it. Oh, starts like a wine, finishes like a beer. So is it a beer or a wine? It's like, So this is like something that I just kind of put together, as you can tell by the hanging G there. And we've got this like three-dimensional spectrum of mead, right? Where we're like somewhere on this XYZ axis is all of these meads. And, you know, maybe one of our more traditional meads would be very still, so over here. Pretty sweet, so over there. But on the rich side of the rich light axis. So that's actually in the background, right? Below. And then we might take one of Fairbrother's meads here that's a little more rich and a little more sweet and just same amount of stillness, just drop it a little bit down and to the right. Then you got Viking's Blood, right? Which is like, whoa, super rich, but still super sweet and super still. So it's just dropped down vertically from these two. And then you got Redstone's Nectar of the Hops, which for me it is pretty dry. So it's going to be on this side of the dry sweet axis. And it's totally sparkling, forced carbonation, but still sparkling, and relatively light and sessionable. So it ends up closer to us in the bottom left. And then California Oak, I would say, is a little bit sweeter than Nectar of the Hops. Definitely sparkling. A bit more rich than Session of Hops, but this is where my three-dimensional thinking like fails. Because they're pretty close to each other in terms of body. But I want us to start thinking about mead this way, because this is how winemakers started thinking about wine, and it went from red and white table wine made in France or Italy to Pinot, to Washington Pinot, Washington Zin, to Southern California Zin, to Rhone varietals, to, you know, like, there was a layer of specificity that the customer was ready for, and they did a lot of educating, but they educated together. So right now, the mead categories for the BJCP are really broad and defined by characteristics. Dessert meads, sack meads, hydromels, melomels, traditional meads, methylgins, they can be sweet, they can be strong, they can be dry, they can be bubbly. Like, you're comparing a lot of the time apples to oranges, and they're in the same category. So it's really hard to differentiate one mead that may be in the same category as another. So we kind of like hung our hat on this idea of specific regional styles of mead. So we want to call these San Diego style meads. And the second mead that we're pouring is called Speakeasy. It's a experimental where we took a much darker honey, used the same ale yeast, and then triple oaked it with French oak. So you get this like bourbon-like quality to it, this astringency to it that's hopefully attractive. And on the same spectrum as California oak, but a way different execution, right? And so, but it's still refreshing, it's still cold, it's still bubbly, there's honey notes, but they're balanced, hopefully. And so I think when we start comparing meads with each other, like if you're comparing saisons with each other, there's a realm of comparison. So you know I'm trying to shoot for this target. As a mead maker, I want to know what target I'm trying to hit at the end point. And that helps me deal with all those questions of yeast selection, honey ratio, temp control, all of these things. Do I want a lot of phenolics? Do I have a yeast that makes good phenolics? Because like this idea that wine yeast is the only good mead fermenter is false. There are, I think every yeast can make mead well if it's given the nutrients that it needs. Because that's really the challenge that we're dealing with in mead making. There's no nitrogen in honey, right? Does this make sense to everybody? That beer and wine bring nitrogen to the party in terms of organic compounds that are present in the matter that's fermented. Honey is basically glucose and fructose, a little bit of trace everything else, but it's naturally antimicrobial, right? When it mixes with water, it creates hydrogen or OH molecules, hydroxyls, is that the right term? And those want to kill yeast. So you got to make your yeast really healthy and strong and give them everything that they need to go into this environment that's very hostile to them. So we've experimented with different yeast profiles, and we started by just simply, thank you, over-pitching. So we would take the recommended pitch rate of our California ale yeast, SAF ale 05, and just multiply it by 3. And like, we got some good results. Like 6 weeks, drinkable. People were loving it. Like knocking the door down, couldn't make enough of it. But it got really sketchy when temp changed, and we didn't have viable temp control at this time. When temp changed, our fermentation was just dragged on like 10 weeks, and we're like, oh no, that's like, you know, $1,500 of honey, that's like $10,000 of mead, and it's not ready, and everyone is pissed at us. You know, that sucks. So we experimented with the all up front nutrient addition, and that would just like rip through fermentation in like 2 weeks. SAF ale 05, two times the pitch rate, and rehydration nutrient, like gopher up front, with the rehydration, add some broad nutrient to the must, and then like leave it. And those like would go in like 2 weeks, and sometimes they'd be awesome, and sometimes they would be totally too dry, no balance to them, too hot. So read Kyle Beverly's article in Craft Beer and Brewing. Oh, look at this. There it is. So his article is just, I think it's 0 to 60 in terms of mead making. If you go track down that article, he lays it out like this is the pretty sure way to get a very consistent fermentation. And I think Michael Fairbrother can attest to this. Like, add yeast nutrient, and Eric too, at Meridian Hive Meadery down in Texas, 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, hopefully prior to the first third of sugars have been fermented. And make sure you're measuring your yeast available nitrogen target and then adjusting your nutrient additions accordingly, because that's going to be critical to a successful fermentation that eats all the nutrients without leaving them over, so you don't get any vitamin, you know, Flintstone vitamin-like flavors at the end. If nutrients aren't fully fermented, they taste noticeable. And don't add your nutrients without degassing first and then liquefying the nutrients. Otherwise, the rapid evacuation of your mead is a big mess to clean up. That's the technical term for it, rapid evacuation.
What are you using for your aeration?
Almost there, right? There it is. All right. Air compressor, oilless, filter, into carb stone, off of racking arm.
It's just standard
air. Oxygen would be rad. We're not at that point yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
and
you're really trying to get O2 out of the air?
Yeah, oxygen for the yeast, but also degassing. It also serves the purpose of getting the CO2 out of solution because I actually didn't finish that point. Ken Schramm points out, whenever you get a chance to talk to him, that mead is a very low buffer medium to ferment in, right? So you've got a stew on one hand, which is your typical beer, and you've got a very thin broth on the other hand, which is your mead. And if you add a teaspoon of salt to each, which one are you going to taste the salt in? The broth, right? Because there's no extra chemical compounds competing on your flavor molecules, and also for the yeast's environment that it's living in. So a bit of CO2 is going to change the pH in your thin broth mead relative to your thick stew beer and make the yeast get out of their happy pH zone very quickly. So aeration in the first 72 hours gets that CO2 out of there, and now you've got a much healthier environment for the yeast to go through the first phase of fermentation and hopefully set them up for success for the following two-thirds. So that's the theory behind aeration and nutrient additions. And then also adding adjuncts, which I skipped over earlier, but since mead is such a low buffer product, adding adjuncts is a much more delicate dance, and doing it very cautiously is critical. If you're doing something with those soap molecules like lavender or rosemary, you can overdo it so easily. So you've really got to like add in increments until you think it's just right. Okay, so... Yeah, my pleasure. So I want to share with you our learning process, because it's not a conclusion yet. You know, I was listening to a TED Talk where they talk about, you know, the toaster oven. Like, we have this perfect toaster oven, and if your toaster oven ever fails, you're like angry, right? Like, what a piece of junk. But the number of years and like thousands, millions of dollars of research that went into that toaster oven working consistently every time, like, it's something we totally take for granted, right? And that's the case with our beer and our wine. And like, the market expects our mead to be damn near perfect. Though you guys are the coolest, because you're like, yeah, you're learning. I get it. But like, we're at the technology adoption curve. Right now, we're sitting amongst a bunch of innovators who are like, hey, that's cool. Let me try that too. And that's like the best audience for our mead in a way. But it's also the smallest tail on the bell curve of humanity. So, like, it's a great challenge that we all have to arrive at a product that we love and are passionate about sharing with people that is technically feasible and also saleable, right? So we started out doing more winey style meads, and they were sweet and dessert-like and really rich, but it made us think, like, are we in the port business here? Like, are we selling a dessert wine? Is this something we can afford to make? Because it takes 6 months to ferment and then another 6 months to age at least, and really gets good after 24 months of aging. And that, at that point, if I was charging what it actually costs to make it and keep the business growing, my friends couldn't drink it. So what's the point of making it? So we pivoted because we met Maury Fletcher, the guy holding the tube earlier. And he showed us his meads, where he's doing 1-4 honey to water, and hitting starting bricks of 19 to 22. I worked in a winery, so like my specific gravity is not as good, but I understand that's like 1.108 in that area. And then finishing bricks like close to 0.7. ABV between 10.5 and 13.5. Luckily, because we're regulated as a wine, the feds give us a 1.5% margin of error for what we put on the bottle, which is nice of them. The taxes that they charge us are not, but, you know. We went with Saffale 05 and 04 because they're very clean fermenters with that ale yeast finish here in San Diego. That is a flavor profile that people are stoked on, and we like it too, of course. No sulfite production, which is, that's not true. With the wrong nutrient additions, sulfites can be a problem, but with the right nutrient additions, like, it's not even a worry. Flocculation has been a challenge, though, when we're trying to get a clearer beer, mead. Yeah, we're not quite there yet. But, you know, people drink wits and saisons, and if you ask me, that's okay. We're never going to win BJCP, AHA mead competitions, because clarity is, like, key. If you don't have clarity, you don't get visual, and it can knock you down from competing with the best of them. But that's okay, because we're doing something different. So as I said, when we started, we just overpitched the yeast. It took 6 to 8 weeks, 2 weeks of conditioning. It was light and refreshing, but way variable. Then the all up front method, 2 to 5 weeks sometimes, but stability was like crazy. So then we read Kyle's article, and I really recommend you guys picking it up in the Craft Beer and Brewing magazine. And this is just one, our most recent fermentation curve. I mean, I took the bricks this morning. It's down from 20.5 on Monday night at 7 p.m. to, Joe, what did I text you this morning? 7.8 on Saturday. So 6 days, it's ripped through 2/3 of the sugar and tasting clean and beautiful. And like, that's just such a game changer for the whole mead world, right? No longer do we have these 2-month, 6-month fermentation times and 2 years of aging. So your turnaround time and experimentation can be so much faster, and hopefully we can all get to better meads faster. So is that how long fermentation is going to go? I expect it to slow down, as it already has, but I would be stoked if 2 weeks is like very, very real. Temp control, you know, depending on your scale, I highly recommend it, because yeast or mead is such a tough medium to ferment in anyways. You might as well invest in some temp control so that that variable is controlled, because that's going to be huge. And honey is expensive, so you don't want to screw it up. We do get temps up to 71 degrees during the first 24 hours to help with that lag phase and reproduction of the yeast, but then we drop it down to 68 for the rest. And then at the last third, if it starts to slow down, we may bump it up and make them, you know, push through. And that is definitely a cleaner, more stable fermentation, though those systems are not cheap, as you all know. So it depends on how invested you are in this process. Adjuncts, do you want to put the Groucho nose on the two-year-old girl? It depends. Depends on what you're going for, you know. Sometimes they can be complimentary and perfect. My friend Billy Betts just poured me a Chipotle mead. Where are you, Billy? That is excellent. If he's got any left, tackle him for it. Like the perfect expression of Chipotle in a mead with orange blossom honey and nuanced and balanced. And it's highly variable, though. So test and record and really get your comfortable level. With ale yeast, it's going to show maybe even more than with wine yeast. So look into that. And I wanted to share our challenges because this is not a finished process by any measure. And I wanted to be totally upfront with the reality we're facing. There's the chance that because we're not filtering our meads, we're just cold crashing for clarity, that the residual sugar that we bottle at, 0.7 Brix, which is 1.03, is that right? Gravity, could ferment out to 8.3 grams per liter CO2 if we bottle at 3.8, which is just below the legal limit of champagne, which helps us avoid paying the federal champagne tax because we bottle below champagne and we sell it and we hope that it's not going to recarbonate. But if it does, it'll get up to 8.3 grams per liter and that'll be champagne level, but not geyser level, right? Where you open the bottle and you get sprayed in the face and it's good for practical jokes, but not good for customers who are trying your product for the first time. So this much more viable yeast can result in a much more effervescent and kind of variable carbonation at the end. We also control that by having champagne thick bottles, right? These things can hold 125 PSI, which is great. You want that sense of comfort that worst case scenario, the mead's just bubbling over. And when it's cold, it really doesn't bubble over at all. But you don't want exploding bottles. And we also don't use preservatives, so no sulfites, no sorbate. And that is something we're kind of hanging our hat on because our ancestors weren't drinking mead with sulfites and sorbate, so we should be able to pull that off too. And Mike agrees with me on that. But we're entering into uncharted territory, and we need you along with us. Also, appearance, talked about that. Unfiltering, viable yeast, they don't totally flocculate out, so you're going to get a more cloudy product. But our customers and you guys are used to that. You drink unfiltered beer all the time. So we're not force carbonating. We're naturally conditioning. We transfer the mead to secondary at about 1.5 Brix in specific gravity. That's 1.09. So there's a bit of sugar left, but we set our PSI, our pressure release valve, on the bright tank at 7 PSI at 68 degrees Fahrenheit. So we have this table that says, at this temp, at this pressure, your grams per liter CO2 should be 3.8, right under the legal limit. So that's how we're controlling in a indirect way what CO2 is present in our product. And then we bottle at 0.7 Brix. Any extra CO2 hopefully gets blown off. We bottle at 0.7 Brix. When the yeast is done, worst case, all the honey is converted and you get a champagne-like San Diego-style mead. So that's where I'm at. It's real time. We're doing it right now. And maybe it's cutting edge, maybe it's bleeding edge. It depends on the month, you know. But I'm happy to answer any questions you guys have, give you my thoughts on it, hear from you guys if you're dealing with the same problems, how you're dealing with them, and then hopefully carry on the conversation somewhere. Okay, let's take a quick poll. Who went on Reddit/Mead last week? A handful of people. Who went on gotmead.com last week? More. About 10 people. Okay. Who made mead last week? Hell yeah. Awesome. That's what I'm talking about. And who made mead last month? Awesome. And who made mead last year? Awesome. Okay, we're in great company here. So we're all thinking about the same problems. So I'm happy to have a conversation with you guys. Drink some more mead. There's plenty. I don't think we've been through four kegs yet. So there's a mic in the back if you guys want to queue up and ask the mic. I think that'll get it recorded, and that'll be available for future audience. Is that true? Are we doing that?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Hey, Frank, thank you. I hope if I drink more mead, I'll be as passionate as you are. I have a newbie question. The ratio by weight or volume?
Volume. Honey is heavier than water, so that can really throw you off if you're doing by weight, so do volume.
And do I need to grow my own bees now if I make mead?
Okay, that's two businesses, and we tried that, and we're putting off the bees until the cash flow from the mead can afford to be a professional beekeeper at a small scale. Yeah.
You talk about pitching rates. So the question on pitching rates, are you using like the websites for an ale yeast, or you come up with your own? Because I thought that honey is a little bit harder to ferment, so you would need more yeast.
So
what do you use?
So that's a complex background to that question. And my understanding, and people correct me if I'm wrong because I didn't study this stuff at school, but honey is glucose and fructose. So attenuation rates that are published are not accurate for mead, especially as you start to play with nutrients and aeration, right? So you can kind of throw that all out the window and start from a baseline and start to experiment. So with the staggered nutrient addition, we've gone back to the recommended pitch rates, but our attenuation is going to be nowhere near what's published because that is calculated based off of maltose and dextrose being present in a beer, which are very complex carbohydrates, takes the yeast a lot more energy. They'd rather fall out of solution than do the work to break down those complex carbohydrates into the simple ones. Fructose and glucose, on the other hand, it's like mead party, and if you got a mead that's healthy enough to deal with the alcohol content, they'll probably eat most of it, if not all of it. We overpitched at first because we weren't going to play with nutrients. We thought that it would create those Flintstone vitamin flavor compounds that we weren't excited about. Now that we're doing the nutrient additions, we're back to following the recommended pitch rate for now. If we have time to experiment and can control variables on a small scale, we'll mess with that.
Ever tried a Belgian ale yeast, and if so, did it work?
So before we had controlled experiments, yes, and it tasted awesome, but it came out flat because we sucked at controlling some variables. Next week, Joe is hopefully using our new keg or our new chest freezer to do some 5-gallon batches, and we'll see where it goes from there. Yeah, but Billy has, right? You've done some Saison yeasts, and they turned out rad. Was it French Saison? Okay, French Saison, not Saison 1 or 2 or a combo, but French Saison.
Yeah, the 3711
Y-Yeast one was the best. So 3711 Y-Yeast French Saison.
That's pretty much what I was going to ask. Any other kind of yeast strains, English strains or lager yeasts or, you know, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we messed with all of them, and they're promising. We kind of had to choose and go forward, and when we found it, we just like stuck to it. And as we grow, that's definitely going to be one problem set we're going to focus on. And shoot, man, I mean, I want to say let's go online on GotMead and just like have yeast discussions. And also, Charlie Bamforth, the chair of brewing science at UC Davis, gave the keynote at the MeadMaker Short Course 2 Februarys ago. And we were like, sweet, Charlie Bamforth is going to talk about mead. And like Michael Fairbrother was there, and Ken Schramm was there, and Mike Fall from Rabbit's Foot were there, and then like a bunch of homemakers, mead makers who were considering going pro, and we're all like eagerly anticipating the answers coming from the font of Charlie Bamforth. And he's like, I would like to know a couple basic questions. What kind of mead is made from what kind of yeast with what kind of honey? Us too, man. Are you kidding? So yeah, we can all make that up. And like, if you come up with a style that is awesome and you love it and people love it, then hopefully that's a new style.
Two-part question. From concept to execution, how long, if someone were considering going into making a meadery, a new meadery? And second part of the question is, how much money?
So if I could do it again, because you'd want to avoid all the mistakes that I made, right? So we've been doing it for 4.5 years, but we were doing wine style meads that took 6 months at the beginning. So I would restart it. I would do just a microbrewery setup, like 3 unitanks, like 10 barrel, a glycol chiller for it, and maybe a bright tank to finish them in. So that's 45K for the 3 bright tanks, 15K for the, for the 3 unitanks, and 15K for the bright tank. So you're at 60K for just your tanks, then a glycol chiller. We got ours for smoking. Are you in San Diego? No? There's a guy, his name's Hassan. Anyways, 3K for the glycol chiller, but you can spend a lot more on them. So let's say 10K for the glycol chiller, so you're at 70. Bottling line, we build ourselves for about $1,000 using the counter pressure filler on that. The plans are out on Pro Brewer message board. We don't do filtration, so we skipped that whole cost. TI on our building was about 10K, and then your first, you know, batch, probably about 20K, so maybe 100K.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Over how many period, how much period of time if you avoid your...
Your mistakes? I mean, you could turn over mead in 6 to 8 weeks and start selling it for 4 times what it cost you to make it.
Concept, though, 2 years, 4 years?
Well, getting the licenses took 6 months, and then we were producing at the same time, which is not legal. So, I know. Statute of limitation? That. All right.
Hey, Frank.
You meant to say
water. Yeah.
So I've been experimenting with Boshe meads.
Boshe's.
If you've ever done that yourself, I'm sure you have.
I have not, actually.
Oh, well, then I had a thought about... You
know, let me clarify for the audience. Boshe is when you caramelize the honey before you ferment it.
And that's where the question lies, is that if you had any experience in it, if you lose attainable sugars because you've caramelized it, much like you would never, you know, there's no enzymatic reaction like when you're converting your malt, but do you have a thought on whether you're going to end up with less attainable sugars and a higher end gravity?
I mean, my educated guess would be yes.
Yeah.
How do you caramelize your Boshe?
You boil it.
Who can speak to that? Ken or Mike or Eric? Anyone? Can anyone speak to attenuation rates with Boshes? Susan? See? Start a Boshe only meadery and you'll be the guy doing it. Stan?
I did a Boshe with Sean at a camp out, and I took some cheap honey. I boiled it down till it got to a dark amber caramelized color. I fermented it with a wine yeast, and it started out at 1065, which is hydromel range, and last I checked it was down to 1020, which was still a pretty high.
How long ago?
Oh, just a couple days ago, actually.
And when did you start it?
Big Brew Day.
In April. Well, first weekend in May.
It was Big Brew Day.
Okay, first weekend in May.
So it was pretty much done fermenting. The bubbling was pretty much stopped. And I tasted it. It definitely had a caramelized honey flavor. The thing that I thought was lacking was honey aroma.
Yeah.
It's like
yeah.
It boiled the honey aroma out.
Yeah. Boshe is just caramelized.
So I'm stalled at 10:30, and so I'm just wondering if that's...
questions so we get it on tape.
Absolutely. So the question was, if you take a Boshe, you caramelize the honey, are you converting some of the sugars into forms that the yeast aren't going to attenuate? Is that going to end differently than you intended with a higher residual sugar? And Stan's point was probably.
Yeah. Thanks, Frank.
You're welcome. We got a line back there. Yes, sir. Ma'am, go ahead.
Excuse me, I'd like to answer his point.
Okay.
Or give a side point. I tried making a Boshe several years ago, and it's one of the few things I've ever dumped. In retrospect, my propane burner is a lot hotter than firewood that was used years ago. Be careful, please.
All right. Thanks.
I appreciate all your enthusiasm. My question is, once in a while I get that, you called it Flintstones vitamin flavor.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my Bear Judge friends also calls it a Cheerio flavor.
Mm.
And I'm wondering how to avoid it. Normally, my yeast nutrient addition is half GoFirm and Fermade K, and I'm wondering if there's something else I can use to avoid it or how I can get that vitamin flavor out of my mead before I bottle it. Sometimes it's come back into the mead 2 months down the road after I bottled it.
So when, so one of the key things when we talk to each other about troubleshooting is how we add nutrient, when, how do we aerate? So how did you add your nutrient and when?
Basically, down to my 3/4 teaspoon in, shook the bottle like hell,
okay,
and covered it back up and went back in the house.
Okay, so with GoFirm,
what do I need to do different?
Well, I mean, we're all in the experimentation, right? The guys that make these products don't have any literature on mead-specific process. But my understanding of GoFirm is you want to heat your water to 110 degrees so that you dissolve all of the nutrients and make them available to the yeast and temperate it down after you've done that dissolution step.
And then add that.
But the Fermade O, the broad scale nutrient, right in the must before pitching.
Okay.
So that's what we do. Results really to be confirmed by someone else in an independent study. So,
okay.
Ken?
Yeah. Using the GoFirm as a nutrient or as a hydration addition?
Basically, just as a nutrient, dry, just kind of dumping it into the fermenter. If I need to rehydrate it, that's what I'm kind of asking.
Yeah. Ken, you want to jump in? Get on the mic, Ken. This is priceless. This is why people pay big money for these tickets.
GoFirm is a rehydration nutrient for the yeast. It's not meant to be used as a nutrient during fermentation. And when you talk about Cheerios, what that makes me think of is possible yeast autolysis. If you've got both Fermade K, it's got a lot of yeast hulls in it, and GoFirm, which is essentially all yeast hulls, that may be where your Cheerios flavor is coming from. To get the nitrogen that you need, you can use the Fermade K for the micronutrients and a small amount of that, and then diammonium phosphate for the nitrogen, the pure amino nitrogen, or just it's an inorganic nitrogen at that point. But for the nitrogen for the yeast, you can use DAP, and that may eliminate some of that Cheerios-esque flavor.
Sweet.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We're all in this together.
Hey, Frank.
Hey.
Big fan. My wife and I are always sitting at your stools over there about every other week.
Thank you. Thank you. And anyway, everyone who's in town is 45 minutes up the coast, just on the 78.
College,
so if you're
college and what is it, Oceanside Boulevard?
That's right. That's right. I got cards if anyone wants them.
Really quick, as far as pitching your nutrients and putting your nutrients in it on the staggered, of course, I'm doing 5-gallon batches. Now, if you're doing, like, say, for instance, the 100-gallon batches, what are we talking as far as quantities go, as far as what you're pitching over that staggered?
We've scaled up just direct. It's not like a herb or a spice where you're like, whoa, I could go way overboard way quick. Like, your yeast needs those things to eat all that sugar at that new volume. So that's my theory. If anyone is open to contesting it, I'm open to hearing, because...
So what would you say the amount is, say, for instance, on like a 100-gallon batch?
25 grams per hectoliter.
Okay.
So anyone good at converting?
All right, where's the mathematician?
But it's basically follow the instructions on the nutrient. But Kyle Beverly, honestly, his article gives you the ratios. You just need to multiply them out.
Great, thanks.
My pleasure.
So just adding into that, so what you're saying is for scaling up, it's more linear than exponential or any sort like that?
So far.
Okay. Very, very good to know. Very good to know. My other question is really based on just asking, have you used any of the local white lab yeasts, and have you had any kind of success with either of his wine yeast, mead yeast, or ale yeast. I mean, LPO, WLPO1 is such a very clean ale yeast.
And it's so comparable to SAF ale of 5, right?
Okay.
So SAF ale of 5 is kind of our adjunct, and replacement. Because that cost, man, white lab stuff is a bit more expensive. And the whole rehydration thing is like uncertain. If you're using liquid yeast, how do you rehydrate it? There's probably micronutrients available on GoFirm during lag phase that the yeast need. So do you add those anyways if you're using liquid nutrient that or liquid yeast? That's what we're going to do when we test it, the saisons. When I did use their yeast in some trial batches, we had such variable results. It was kind of like, let's go with what we know and is working well, and we can get in volume. But we are going to try the saison yeasts next week. What we're going to do is add the, so the question was, during rehydration with liquid yeast, do you add rehydration nutrients? And to me, since it's so early in the fermentation, they're probably going to get consumed. So I would rather have them there. And if there's some, at UC Davis, actually, they did some controlled studies with DAP additions and found that there was a limit where DAP is no longer effective. You could add 50 milligrams per liter or 250 milligrams per liter, and the outcome is the same. So their conclusion was there's probably some micronutrient that's absent that we need. And to me, that's what GoFirm is all the micronutrients that the yeast need to have a healthy, long fermentation. So I might as well add it to the liquid yeast pitch so that when lag happens, it's available to them.
That's a good point. I was just thinking the same thing, like make a beer out of the yeast and then use the yeast from that beer. I'm sure there's a local brewery somewhere in Oceanside that might give you some yeast.
Maybe a couple.
Maybe, you know.
I might have to trade him some mead. We'll see.
Yeah. Pitch in some mead. But who here also makes beer and reuses your yeast? Why not make a mead with it?
So what do you call that when everyone thinks something? Traditional knowledge? Is that right? Yeah.
Common
it doesn't happen to me very the traditional knowledge on yeast repitches from mead fermentations is that they're so beat up, they're so exhausted, that you're going to have a way less viable yeast at the end. With the nutrient addition, maybe this is not the case, right? Like, with those 4 to 6 month fermentations, that makes sense, but with these 2 week fermentations that are similar to beer, maybe we've got viable yeast to repitch.
Yeah, you might, but I would still think the brewer, you know, they can give you a clean sample, for lack of a better term, that you could pitch that.
Yeah.
So, I'm not sure if it would be pure, like all of the yeast that's in there. You'd have beer particles, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. The question was, can you repitch from a brewer who has spent their yeast? And I think it's something we kind of left off the experimentation table because we've got enough to mess with right now. But maybe at some point in the future. Yeah, thank you.
I've always used Ferment K and DAP.
Yeah.
That's my nutrient base. I saw in your slides you were talking about Ferment O.
Yeah.
What's the difference between Ferment O and Ferment K, and which do you prefer and why?
So O is organic. We're adding it up front because there's no DAP. Ferment K includes DAP, and DAP is DAP. Diammonium phosphate, which is inorganic yeast nutrient. When the yeast are going through lag, my understanding is DAP makes them unhappy. So adding Fermate O is the softest way to introduce them to the fermentation environment without the challenges DAP poses.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Making it up as we go. But sharing it with you guys in the hopes that your knowledge and experimentation will help us accelerate and your meads out there making people realize that mead can be awesome all the time. And it's not just when you try Fairbrothers or Schramm's or our mead or Susan's or Eric's, sorry. You know, like, we need more good mead out there. So if you guys are making it, we want to see it.
Hi, so I have a friend that is interested in blending coffee and mead.
Ooh.
I just would like your take on that.
I've never made a Coffamel. You have. Shram, have you?
I got two. Right down the street is Brad, and he's doing a really good one.
Bee Nectar. And then Susan, have you done one? So Mike, you want to take it? Sorry, Eric, are you guys doing coffee media or not doing coffee media?
Not yet.
Not yet, yeah.
We will.
But you've experimented with them, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we've done several meads with coffee. Our preferred coffee of choice is a Sumatran coffee base. So 72 hours, you grind up the coffee beans, espresso grind, finish your mead up first, and then it's like cold or coffee hopping or whatever it's called, coffeeing the mead. You steep the coffee into the mead for 72 hours, pull it off, you get great aromatics, you get great flavor, and keeps the color light with no bitterness.
You've won a ton of awards for that one, right?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I just had a quick question. I think this has probably already been answered just a minute ago. I've read Ken's book and hearing you guys talk about using the Fermade K and DAP. And, you know, when you look at Fermade K's site, they kind of suggest that there's DAP in there, but they don't outright say it. So that's something that's confused me for a long time. I'm thinking, well, if it has it, then why do I want to also add DAP? And if I do, then can I overdo the DAP?
It's on the box. Yeah.
Scott Labs did great articles on all their the chemicals.
Though Fermentis, I was just talking to the Fermentis rep out on the floor, and he's like, DAP spikes activity, but it doesn't sustain it the way that Fermate O or another organic nutrient will. You won't get as big of a spike with Fermate O, but you get a much longer rate. And they did that by measuring CO2 production, which makes a lot of sense, right? It's an instantaneous measurement of yeast activity. So they were saying that after a DAP addition, you get this huge boost, but it's like giving them crack, and they just, duh. Whereas Fermate O, you get a boost, but it plateaus and stays. So in the near future, I'm hoping to experiment and get the DAP out of there. Ken Trim, go into the mic, please.
Fermade K was formulated to augment a lot of components in wine musts. And that's why it has a lower level of DAP than we need, because wine musts already come, even in very low nitrogen level grape varieties, the available nitrogen levels are pretty high in for us. And so they're adding a small amount. The justification for Fermade K is it's got all the micronutrients that you need, plus a small amount of nitrogen. Well, we need all the same level of micronutrients, but we need a higher level of nitrogen because there's almost none in honey. So that's why we're supplementing with DAP.
Every time I see Ken Trim talk, I just get excited. Thanks, man.
So we're talking about nutrients. So if you're not able to measure the yan and such as in winemaking, you can get away with making some assumptions.
You can assume zero.
Right. So if you aren't measuring yan on larger batches of mead, is how much of an issue is that of making?
I mean, we just assume zero and calculate 350 grams per milliliter. Grams per milliliter.
So assume is that right? Zero.
No, that's definitely not. Grams per liter, thanks. Needed, and then formulate our Fermade O, Fermade K, DAP to achieve that. Because they all have different layers, or excuse me, levels of yan.
And that's safe to do because in mead making, you're not having as much nutrients, correct?
Safe to do is like asking Columbus. Is it safe to go to the New World?
So how critical is it measuring yan if you don't have the test equipment to measure yan?
It's not. I mean, you can just assume zero, right?
Okay.
Yeah, am I wrong?
A little bit, because we've done some research at our meadery on yan and meads. And
thanks, Eric.
But yeah, the tests that we've done, we found that most honey musts are between 15 and 45 ppm of yan, which is
zero.
Which is not very much, and we use DB10 pretty much exclusively. Sometimes we do 47, and it likes around 280 ppm of yan. And you can find the Got Mead has a lot of threads that talk about this, and every year at the Maser Cup, I talk to these guys about how they calculate all that, and we put that into our spreadsheets, and it's pretty much right on. So this the knowledge that they have is really a way to go if you want to dive into this. There's a lot of research that some of those home meat makers have made in this area. But around 300, 350 seems to be a good number. There are some strains, if you use some of the like Belgian yeast and some of the like D254, and RC212 like 400 plus. So your mileage will vary, but really the best way to do it, I would say, if you're not sure, do like little like 1 gallon batch and just experiment with it there. And once you learn your yeast, then if you're using that yeast in the future, you'll know what it likes, because our nutrient additions are different than Frank's. We use Fermato in the back end because that's what our yeast strain likes. So if we were using D254, I would put all the Fermato up front because it gets cranky really early on, whereas we can come out of leg for a little bit and then add the DAP and then it's happy, but it slows down and we have the Fermato and immediately the fermentation picks up. You kind of have to experiment with your yeast in order to learn what it likes, because they're all really different.
And what are you looking for to gauge a successful nutrient addition?
The two factors that we watch are fermentation kinetics, which is the rate of fermentation. So that's basically you plot every 12 hours, you plot your gravity. And our yeast always, when it's happy, it ferments at 7 to 8 gravity points every 24 hours. And if that slows down, then we know that something's wrong. The other thing that you can see is that pH will fluctuate very widely. When the yeast get mad, the pH changes. So if you plot the pH and you see a blip in your pH, that usually means that the yeast are not happy about something.
Right.
And so they immediately then, when you make them happy, the yeast, the pH will correct. So that's the other variable that we watch, and we just plot. So when we do anytime we do a new must, we're doing a new recipe, we'll plot every 12 hours, we'll plot the pH and the gravity, and that tells us like how the fermentation is progressing.
Do you have a specific pH range that you like to keep it
at? It depends. I mean, DB10 doesn't seem to care about like higher acid. We have a mead that we make with Wahia honey, which is really high in gluconic acid. It's probably the TA is around almost 2. Which is extremely acidic. Most
you're doing TAs?
Are like 1.5 if you do a TA test. And the pH in that and the fermentation gets to down to 2.4. And the yeast still keep going somehow. We don't know how. They're champions. But with some other yeast, they would just completely quit at that range. So
what about your more traditional sessionable or on-premise tap meads?
Yeah. The session meads that we do are where the pH is around 3.2.
3.2.
Yeah. Okay. And at that rate, the fermentation kinetics are very rapid. I mean, we get full attenuation in about 7 days, usually.
7 days?
Yeah.
And starting breaks or starting gravity of?
It's about 1050 specific gravity.
Okay. Cool. Thanks, Eric. Yep. Billy.
So if ale yeasts require higher nitrogen levels than most wine yeasts, right? I've heard different numbers out there. What's the average PPM needed for an ale yeast in terms of yen? Does anyone?
I have no idea. Okay. Anybody?
Eric, you said 3 to 350. Was that for wine yeast, though?
Yeah, I think I would start with 350, which is where he's at.
Yeah, and we're getting good results.
Yeah. Okay.
But talk to your yeast provider.
Yeah.
Your yeast yen demands are actually lower.
Oh, they are.
Ken, microphone. You're delivering value to thousands of people.
Okay, most beer musts have 145 to 185 ppm a yen, and beer yeasts are acclimated to that, so they're fine with lower yen levels. And as a rule, they're not trying to produce 12 to 15% of alcohol, and so they do just fine at those levels. 300 for 12 pp or for 12 percent ETOH is pretty much the standard, and if you get above 12, you're looking for 350. So,
so guess from there.
Since I got Ken right next to me. So if I make a mead with an ale yeast and I shot for 350 ppm, and fermentation goes all the way through, dries out. But there's some notes of sulfur at the end, which for mead, I think, is often lack of nitrogen, right? So I took that to mean that the ale yeast needed more, but would there be another cause for sulfur notes?
Temp control.
Okay, are you doing, so just two.
Are you doing temp?
Not on the batch that smelled like sulfur.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then a little copper sulfate, you know, knocks it out pretty quickly. If aeration doesn't.
Is it temperature control where warmer or colder?
Usually it's warmer, but your yeast has its happy range. If it got out of that happy range, sulfur can happen. Yeah. It's 3:04, guys. I'm happy to keep answering questions. I think I'm the last presenter in this room. And look at this, man. We're talking about stuff that no one else has ever talked about. Woo! Yes. Yes. So I've got another 20 minutes or so if you guys want to come up. Or no, let's keep doing it. I think that, Steve, is it cool if we just keep recording? All right. Steve says it's cool. So we'll keep recording. Mike Fairbrother is going to leave, though. He's kind of a big deal. He's actually our new president of the American Mead Makers Association. So, so yeah, let's keep talking for another 20 minutes. If it breaks up, I've got a stack of cards that I'll put on the table, and you're welcome to grab them. My personal card and our tasting room card. And let's keep talking questions and troubleshooting and everything.
Okay, I'm going to get away from nitrogen here. I live in Seattle, and we have very soft water. Not a lot of mineral content.
Oh, no, water is something I know nothing about. But that's okay. Let's see if someone else in the audience does.
It falls in the Cascades, and 75 miles later, it's in the Sound, so it doesn't have a lot of time to pick up stuff. I have found I've always needed to add a little bit of calcium.
Okay.
And I normally use calcium chloride, about half a teaspoon in a 5-gallon batch. Does anybody have any thoughts about the necessity of calcium? I find when I don't use it, my pHs drop a lot. And I know calcium is very important in moderating mash pH, and I'm wondering if it's the same sort of effect.
Wow. I'll let Eric answer that.
So I have some feedback on that directly. So we're in Austin, Texas, and our water, our calcium, free calcium is around 28. So we actually add gypsum to our meads in order to get the calcium over 50. We found that if we don't do that, that it's absolutely annoying to try to get the yeast to flocculate because they don't want to drop out. It takes weeks to get it to clear. When we started adding the gypsum, we can crash it, and within a couple of days, the yeast are gone. So,
Joe, take notes. Gypsum, all right. Thanks, Eric. I also think, we use our spring water. It tastes like a pretty, we've never done water analysis on it.
Oh.
So, yeah, don't even know.
You mentioned for bottle conditioning in the home, mead maker, you use the champagne bottles, your special corks?
Caps.
Could a person use, say, an easy cap liter bottle or bottle cap bottles at home? We monitor the fermentation, make sure it's ready to condition.
Well, we're just using crown caps and just the air compressor actuator. So it's pretty much the same as the hand-topped one, but you want to make sure that your Brix or your residual sugar is, if it all gets converted, you're not going to exceed the capacity of that bottle. And there are tables for this, and I think the responsible thing to do is ensure you've got 3 to 4 times safety on top. So champagne bottles. Just do champagne bottles.
Just go do four. And wear eye protection.
Cheers.
Going back to a previous point you were making with the sulfur contents coming out with temperature control, is that low or higher temperature control?
My experience has always been that sulfur gets produced in higher temps. We're in San Diego.
And other things from beer rather than not being able to get the stuff out later on.
There's different things to do to get it out, where you can bubble. You can bubble carbon dioxide through it to try and strip the sulfur out, and then adding copper sulfate and racking is another great way to get sulfur out if it happens. But temp control is a way to prevent it.
Prevent.
Yeah.
And keep it lower.
Keep it in within the range, the recommended range, and as long as it's got the nitrogen and it's in recommended range, I think that's the 95% solution. Cool. All right, guys. This was a lot of fun. Thank you. Oh, yeah. All right. We got it. Okay. We're good. Thank you, guys. Yeah, no. Go drink some more mead, and hope to see you at the tasting room.